You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
If we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog,
City Limits.
Well, here we are, City Limits, as I was saying. It's the first Wednesday of the month. In fact, it's April Fool's Day, and we're going to be talking to John McPherson, as usual. It's our first Wednesday, therefore it's transport, talking about public transport and transport generally today. And, of course, this month it's now free, in fact. Which people might have thought was an April Fool's joke, but it isn't, it's true. There we are. So we'll be talking to John a little later in the program. And I'm Kevin Healy. And Antimony has once again drawn the short straw. Anne's away on leave. Antimony, a cup of tea for at least some sort of payment for doing this. We'll give you a cup of tea. And I think Inez said she'd like a cup of tea as well. She'll wander into the studio shortly and pick hers up. There we are. This is all very lovely because I'm sure our listeners are just finding this the most thrilling experience of their life to hear all this. Right, there we are. Now, you got a blue or a... I'll give you the blue cup. Have the blue cup. Yeah, there you are. Okay.
Thanks very much, Kevin. Right, I'm all behind the throne today. And I'll be mostly staying quiet.
And of course, I think today we're going to start off because it seems to have excelled itself this week. Our old mate, the Herald Sun, it's really, really got overboard. I mean, I was just saying before, if you read the Herald Sun, you'd have no idea that they'd caught Desi Gleeson, for instance. Is that his name? What if his name is the bloke who allegedly shot a couple of coppers? Because they only gave 11 pages to it yesterday, and I thought, well, how much can you squeeze out of one story, for God's sake? But anyway, they managed to squeeze 11 pages, which is hardly squeezing. I'd have a sip of tea. But they have exceeded themselves. Last week they had a real problem because there were two strikes. One by teachers, which was a very good strike, and congratulations to them, by the way. And the other one was, of course, the ABC staff that went out for 24 hours. Now, in the education strike, it was against the state government. Here's the Herald Sun with two of their H, unions and the state government, the socialists, the terrible state socialists. So they actually gave a reasonably favourable report to the teachers' strike because it was opposed to the state government that they like even less. Day one. Day two, when the ABC staff went on strike, and of course this is exacerbated by the fact that they regard the ABC as so terribly left-wing, and of course it... deep down, it exposes just how bad they are, I guess, in many ways. And I don't think the ABC is even mildly left-wing, really, but everyone sees it that way, or they do. but, therefore, that coverage was completely the opposite. News programs hijacked to justify strike action. ABC staff air their pay grievances. Hit the pub. How disgusting. ABC staff hijacked the airwaves yesterday to tell their viewers and listeners why they needed a pay rise of more than 10%. And that goes on to say it's a taxpayer-funded pay rise. Antimony, how awful. A taxpayer-funded pay rise. But then they conclude the story saying many ABC staff headed to the pub on Wednesday afternoon with some spotted at the Lansdowne Hotel, which is close to ABC's ultimate headquarters in Sydney, despite holding signs earlier in the day saying they could not afford their power bills. I mean, how disgusting. Can't afford their power bills, but they go to the pub. Now, of course, one might think, well, if you can't afford your power bills, you might as well go to the pub and let them pay the power. That aside, you know, that incredible coverage. And then yesterday they come up with another story the Communication and Media Authority that the ABC had put false information into a Four Corners program. The ABC is in damage control, etc. Now, in this case, they may well have not checked enough to see whether they said there was a fire lit that probably there wasn't. But the story was actually about the cotton industry and its use of water, and the fact that, as we know, cotton uses incredible amounts of water, and how it was using water that could be used for much better purposes. That part of the story still stands up. It was tied up water grab, in fact, the whole episode, which was back in August 2024. But the Herald Sun's made an absolute point of this thing, that on one fact about someone lighting a fire in a paddock somewhere, they got it wrong, and therefore the whole thing is up the thing. But nonetheless, it doesn't change the fact that the base of the story was absolutely true, and that there is a water grab going on. But that didn't worry the Herald Sun. Another interesting story last week I found. I got a fair bit of Herald Sun this morning because it's just so good. And now there's a story on page 19 of last Friday about the fact that a woman has become the Dame Sarah Mullally as the new Archbishop of Canterbury, the first woman Archbishop of Canterbury. That's what the story's about. Hold on to your hats, there's a woman in charge of the church, but the hold on to your hats bit is because there is Princess, whatever her name is, Kate, you know, who we all love, holding on to her hat as she goes in, and there's a photo of Kate with some other woman. And one would have thought that with a story about the Archbishop of Canterbury being the first Archbishop, the first woman, there might have just been a photo of the Archbishop of Canterbury herself, but no, there's two photos of Kate, but none of the Archbishop, which I found fascinating. And then on Monday, there's a big story on page 2. Latest outrage involves women in stolen car. Anti-Jewish hate incidents increase. Now, certainly there is genuine anti-Semitism, and I'm sure there is some of it. We abhor that totally. But there's a long, long story with a photo of people sitting at a restaurant that got attacked. And the usual Herald Sun carry on about anti-Semitism taking over society. And next to it, a very small article, five paragraphs, about an attack at Queen Victoria Market on Sunday, where a celebration Eid in the city had to be cancelled because of anti-Islamophobia events that caused it to be called off. The Queen Victoria Market is investigating an alleged attack by one of its security staff during the Eid in the cell on Sunday. Salem Fest, one of two organisers of the event alongside the City of Melbourne, posted a message on its social media accounts about 2 p.m. notifying followers the event had been cancelled. "We are deeply saddened to share that our Palestinian artists, team and supporters were attacked and subjected to harassment by a Queen Victoria Market security staff member," that said, "we have formally lodged a complaint, and the experience of anti-Muslim and anti-Palestinian racism has shaken us. There is no place for racism, etc." And that's the entire story, next to a much longer one, much, much longer one, about similar things happening in the Jewish community. So again, it's just the sense of balance that which ones. Clearly, anti-Semitism is much more important and much worse, apparently, than Islamophobia, you'll be pleased to know. Also, they had a couple of pages devoted and a front page picture as well, which I didn't bother to bring in. But "Put Our Best Foot Forward, Team Effort Raises $1.32 million for Kids," and the Good Friday appeal. And there's lots of photos of people in the fun run on Sunday. Now, the city was closed down for this all over the place, this fun run. They complain that anti-Palestine Sunday rallies were causing massive disruption to the business in the city, that people couldn't go about their business, that that Jewish people were afraid to go anywhere near the city on those days, as people congregated outside the State Library, which I always thought was pretty hard to work out how people standing outside the State Library were making it impossible for business to operate in Melbourne on the Sunday, but apparently it did. But then when it's a run for the kids and the Herald Sun sponsors it and is part of it, it's okay to close the whole city down on Sunday. Yeah, because it's for a good cause. Good cause. So that's just fun to know. Now also, they've got, of course, a columnist called Rita Panahi, who is also is on his Sky News thing as well, along with Andrew Bolt. And I think they try to outdo each other to see who can be the worst of the two. But anyway, Rita had a 50th birthday recently, and it was reported that she went on this, she was on this boat trip overseas off the US coast. She visited Mar-a-Lago, where of course Donald is, and the boat was estimated as $25,000 a day to hire this boat for her and all her friends to have this wrap-up party. And they said, well, she works for the Herald Sun and she probably earns a good bit of money, but, you know, it's the amount of money that went out on this birthday was lavish. Well, now it's been discovered, you'll be pleased to know, Antimony, it was funded by good old Gina, her close mate Gina, funded the day for her to give Rita a great little birthday party, which I think is just such fun. And in fact, Gina was recently captured on a video making a vocal salute to America, singing the Lee Greenwood song God Bless the USA. So that's just lovely, isn't it? And Panahi, in an article, criticised the media and activist class for criticising Reinhardt, she arguing she would be a hero among feminists if she were a garden variety lefty. But because she speaks common sense, she advocates for policies that benefit ordinary Australians, she's attacked and maligned. And she's previously called Reinhardt undoubtedly the greatest ever business leader we've had in this country, and backs her in a dispute with her family, which of course we know is just fun in the Reinhardt family. Now, I raise this because, again, or just for its own sake, but also yesterday she had her readers back in Australia, had her regular column, and I think to show just how much she's on the ball, it's an article in which she concludes by saying, anyone who considers the radically left-wing Anthony Albanese government as centrist has got an interesting relationship with reality. So, according to Rita, Anthony Albanese is radical left-wing. Antimony, is that how you see him by any chance?
The hero of the working class, Kevin.
Yeah, well, he is a working class hero, that's right. Yes, very much so. But I think that sums up Rita, doesn't it? Antimony nodded then, by the way, in case you're wondering. Okay, we'll move on. And last week I mentioned that Google was hoping to spend millions
Data
centre? Data centre, yeah. Sorry, I had a complete blank then. Data centre in Australia, talk about blank. Their only question is, does this mean they might now come under Australian law in terms of taxes? Because it turns out, as we pointed out, that these companies that send off profits to their own subsidiaries overseas because they owe them debts and all that, they go off to tax havens, so they totally minimise their Australian taxes. And so they're a bit worried about the fact that this might lead, this $20 billion investment in a data centre might lead to them having to pay more tax in Australia. So they're trying to sort that one out. Now, Jim Chalmers, at least to his credit, has said, well, they have to deal with the tax office. He's not going to change the law because they're suggesting maybe the law should change, which allows them to come here and not pay tax. Again, though, they point out what they said last week, reiterate that Google is not asking for incentives, public funds, or changes to the treatment of its existing businesses. Well, they wouldn't want that because their treatment currently is magnificent from their point of view. But anyway, Jim Chalmers, thus far to his credit, has said he's not going to do anything to help them and they have to deal with the tax office to work out what their problem might be. And he says that if he made a concession to them, it would be then set the precedent for all other these companies to come and get the same concessions that would mean they could dodge taxes here. So thus far, we'll keep an eye on that because thus far he's holding out, but how long will he hold out for? That's the big question. Although we know this Labor government never goes to water under pressure, does it? No, absolutely not. Now, you'll also be pleased to know, I found this one fascinating. There's these weight loss drugs, but it's suggested that they might cause you to feel sad and melancholy. They can kill your libido and suck the joy from the marrow of your life, as one user said. But a scientist called Lotte Bier-Knudsen, Danish woman, has spoken at a conference here this week and said that's absolute rubbish. She's tested it. She's done a lot of work on the science of this, and we've documented numerous articles how specific the mechanism is and how these medicines work, and the its drug certainly does not cause these problems. Now, that's very good, except it might have a lot more credibility if someone else did it, because she happened to be one of the scientists who works for Novo Nordisk, the pharmaceutical giant that developed the drug. And she helped develop the drug that she's now saying doesn't cause the problems that people who use it claim it causes. But, and maybe it does or doesn't. It's no scientific proof either way at this point. But I think the person who invented the drug telling us, no, it's quite safe and don't worry about it, is not as reliable as it might be. That's all I thought. But anyway, we'll see what happens. There was also a case, just an interesting little case, where Broken City Council, and there was a case around a planning thing of some sort. But one of the lawyers, Keith Redenbach, he from Redenbach, mob called Redenbach Legal, the judge did an assessment, as did the other side involved in the case, and worked out that he was charging on the basis of days that couldn't have possibly been, because they were 30 and 36 hour days and there's only 24 hours in a day. The bill came to $10 million. It's been a long case over many years, but the judge did suggest that we need to go back and check through all this because the judge, Judge Petten, found that the explanations by Redenbach were incredible and unsatisfactory and took a dim view of his tendency to blame others. And she, that's the judge, concluded the council paid for services not rendered, and the impossible invoices to an assessor to figure out exactly how much was overpaid. But apparently, having assessed what they were being charged and what was on the bills, the lawyer was working sort of 2 days in every one or something. So that one was sorted out. Now we're going to go to John McPherson very shortly, but a couple of other things that have happened. The UN this week had a vote in which a vast majority, 123 in favour, 3 against and 52 abstentions, declaring that the African slave trade is the gravest crime against humanity, which is a very important decision. There's a book I read recently, it was actually published many years ago, called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, I think it's called. And it, goes very deeply into these questions. Anyway, that was passed. But of course, the abstentions, the ones against, were the US, Israel, and Argentina. Why Argentina? Don't know, but anyway, the US and Israel was understandable, but Australia unfortunately was also in the 53 abstentions lot, which is a pity, because I think clearly it's something we should be supporting. But the US called the text highly problematic and does not recognise a legal right to reparations for historical wrongs that were not illegal under international law at the time they occurred. Well, bad luck. We also object to the resolution's attempt to rank crimes against humanity in any type of hierarchy, so therefore they'd vote against any of them, because you're going to have a hierarchy of some sort, I suppose. But it's an important decision, but it's just a pity that one Australia abstained and the US will predictably and Israel voted against. And of course, people have been talking all morning about Israel's dreadful current law about executing. And of course, that law, I mean, what's going to happen is that as the settlers continue to burn and destroy and kill, someone's going to react and take on a settler, and that person's going to get hung for reacting to what the occupiers are doing to them. But also we have Pete Hegseth, who's one of the great minds. And it's only in recent years that Hegseth has seen the Lord, by the way, but now he's seen the Lord. He really has seen the Lord. And he says every day on bended knee with your family, in your schools, in your churches, in the name of Jesus Christ, pray for victory in battle and the safety of our troops, and lots of similar stuff. Our capabilities are better, our will is better, our troops are better. The providence of our Almighty God is there protecting those troops, and we are committed to this mission. Incredibly, the Pope came out and said, that's crap. And he said, God does not listen to the prayer of those who wage war. This is our God, a God who refuses war. Well, I think the Crusades and everything else would put a lie to some of that in terms of how they think, but that's beside the point. And other religious people have also come out and got stuck into them over it. But that's Pete's go at this stage. So I thought before we go to John, we'd play a particular track this week because of Pete and his dedication to Jesus and Jesus loving war and wanting to bless the American troops. And secondly, because it's Easter anyway, and that's part of the whole festival. So we're going to play this song by Barbara Streisand. It's on her Stony End album. It's actually the title track, Stony End. And we're playing it because you'll pick it up in the second line. There's a lovely line that says, I was raised on the good book Jesus till I read between the lines. So let's play Barbara Streisand, and then we'll talk to John McPherson about transport. Barbara Streisand, Stony End, that's the title track of that album. And of course, as I said, I was raised on the good book Jesus till I read between the lines. So thanks, Pete Hegseth, and Easter coming up. On the line, John McPherson. And John, April Fool's Day, we could open up by saying, well, everything's perfect in Melbourne public transport, but people would know that was April Fool. But also, if 2 days ago we'd said, All public transport in Victoria is free, they'd also say, oh, that's an April Fool's joke, but it happens to be true, John.
Yeah, it absolutely is, Kevin. Yes, our benevolent government is giving us a month, at least 1 month, of free public transport because of the spiralling cost of petrol and diesel. Yes. It's interesting what they can do when they, you know, when the... the market, you know, changes, you know, when things like, you know, the people who all drive their cars everywhere, suddenly their life gets a little bit tougher, how the government can step in to help, quote unquote, help, yes.
Interesting to see, of course, what this leads to in terms of numbers on public transport, but also the impact of pollution if there's far less cars on the road. I mean, it's
good thought. Yeah. Well, who knows what we'll see. The drop in patronage on public transport, you know, that happened with COVID. I don't think that's been totally recovered since COVID finished a couple of years ago. So it'll be interesting to see whether this boosts usage back to the levels it was at before COVID or even higher. And, of course, what happens when when things return to normal, if they ever do return to normal, with supplies of petrol and diesel available and at the prices that people think they can afford.
Well, it might drag on because the news this morning is that Trump's looking for a way out, and he might well declare that he's won the war and get out, but leave the Straits of Hormuz still blocked. And well, he's virtually saying the rest of the world, you can go and sort that one out. Seeing I caused it, you now go and sort it out. So in fact, the fuel crisis might last much longer.
Well, that's right. Well, he's accusing the Europeans of not playing in his sandpit with him, and so he's going to go. He's going to go and find another sandpit and leave them to muck around and try and find a way out.
And of course, Jesus blessing the war effort from Pete Hegseth that doesn't extend to fuel, obviously.
Oh well, I'm sure it doesn't. I'm sure it does in Pete's mind.
Well, of course, his argument is: if God made the fuel that's there to be used, and the coal, and all the other things that pollute and destroy,
Kevin, you should be taken on as an advisor. You know all the lines.
That's right, John. I'm going to read you a letter that was in the Age a couple of weeks ago.
I'm all ears. I'm brave.
A lead letter about this. Mm-hmm. Now, with all tankers stranded in the Persian Gulf and only 28 days of petrol on hand, Australia's energy vulnerability is impossible. But it goes on to say the only real solution, I won't read the whole letter, but it goes on to say the only real solution are electric cars and becoming much less reliant on diesel and other fuels anyway.
Well, that's a nice leading question, Kevin. I'd agree with that completely. I think that's definitely the way to go. But of course, none of this stuff can be done overnight. But we already have, quite a large stream of electric cars coming onto the market, mostly coming from China. It's interesting how our big, our big adversary to the north is also our biggest trading partner, which always strikes me as slightly weird, but that's how things are. So the stream of solar panels to generate renewable energy, renewable electricity, and the cars to use it are coming from China. And, of course, it's starting to happen that electric buses and trucks are also happening, and of course they're mostly coming from China as well. So we're quite a long way behind the eight ball compared with European countries, or certainly China itself, in our adoption of electric vehicles. But we have at least started to have that happen.
There was a woman interviewed on the ABC yesterday who has a trucking company up in northwest Victoria somewhere. And she was arguing very strongly that that electric trucks are the only real solution at the moment to the crisis.
Well, I think she's got a point. We don't appear to be. We've only got our two oil refineries left operating. We have to import. I think it's well over 90% of our diesel fuel gets imported. We've run out of crude oil pretty much to process anyhow into petrol and diesel, so it's pretty much got to come from overseas. I'm really glad to hear that she's so progressive that she wants to go electric. It seems to be quite doable. Some of the biggest of the auto and truck building companies, the big Chinese makers like BYD, etc., are building electric trucks, as are Mercedes-Benz, Volvo, and a couple of others in Europe, and Tesla. Tesla's on the road with electric trucks as well. So that's all good, and presumably in time that will all happen. Then, of course, there's buses. We've got just a few electric buses on test in Victoria, running just a few routes in Melbourne. But in Sydney, they've got a lot higher number of electric buses than we've got. Surprise, surprise! They're a bit more advanced there in a lot of ways. But 80% of China's urban buses are now electric, and that must start to have quite an impact on the pollution in big, you know, their huge cities. So once again, it's all happening, but only here in a very small way so far.
Yeah, okay. And another letter in The Age, John. Oh, this is an interesting one from a long-term activist, Rosemary Weston. You know Rosemary?
I think, certainly know the name,
But she had a league letter a couple of weeks ago again saying if the Albanese government decides to fund the first stage of the suburban rail loop, emboldened by Infrastructure Australia taking its hands off the wheel, we can say goodbye to the airport rail and the more modest, cost-effective and necessary road and rail infrastructure projects for the western and northern growth areas. Despite continuing concerns around the SRL's business plan in parentheses, including the costs, value capture plan and needing more detail, IA has pushed SRL onto the top investment rung of its priority ladder. This leaves airport rail infrastructure for zero-emission freight vehicles, the Western and Northern Rail project, down on the 2 to 4 year pipeline rung. And she goes on to say, but just on those points, John, I know you've always been critical of this anyway.
Yeah, well, I'm still critical of suburban rail loop. And Rosemary is critical too, in a sort of indirect way, in that she wants everything by the sound of it. Is that the tenor of the letter?
Yeah, that's right. Well, look,
I think she thinks
other things have priority. Like
I'd agree with that. But yes. And it's true, the government still keeps digging itself in a bigger and bigger hole into the suburban rail loop. But the way they've been letting contracts and so on and so forth, it's the first section in southeast and urban Melbourne is going to be built a bit from Cheltenham up to Box Hill. It seems like that's what they're focusing on at the moment. There's a problem. There is a problem. It's going to be so hugely expensive. I think the whole, even if you wanted to build something like the suburban rail loop, it doesn't have to be built as a full on high cost metro system. There are other ways to build it where it would do the job that's more relevant to the amount of traffic that's likely to use it, than this full on metro, all underground and all built at vast expense. Can I go on and just talk about rail and dealing with the problem with fuel, with diesel fuel.
You can, John. You can certainly.
Oh, good. Yes, thank you. Thank you. around half of the freight in Australia still goes by rail. If you count all the bulk freight, that's all the coal and the iron ore and the grain and all those heavy freight that goes by the train load. If you add all that up, half of the freight in Australia is still on rail, but not a lot of that is electric rail at the moment. There's quite a large electrified rail network in central Queensland that hauls coal to the ports for export, and that's really the main place where electrified rail is used for freight.
Is that the privately owned line?
Uh, let's see, that's a privately owned line. No, that's a government-owned network, in fact. It's very unclear up there, I think, which is public and which is private. But no, the great transport builder, Joe Bjelke-Petersen, built the electrified rail network in central Queensland for hauling coal to the ports, would you believe, 30 odd years ago.
That's almost like an April Fool's joke, John.
Well, it is a bit, but he did. Apparently, the reason goes is that he'd built a new power station and didn't have any way to use the power. So the government thought, aha, we'll electrify the railways. So they did. They electrified a large part of the Queensland railways. So, you know, good can come in strange ways. So there you go. Anyhow, the efficiency of electrified rail is far higher than diesel-hauled rail freight. And diesel-hauled rail freight is far more efficient than road-hauled rail freight. Diesel-hauled road freight using electricity would be far more efficient than running on diesel fuel, so batteries. So you get a double whammy. If you go with electrified rail freight, you end up with a huge increase in efficiency compared with using diesel trucks on the road. But that would be too much, I think, for Australia to entertain in one go. We'll have to get there in a few slices, even though Albanese used to be the federal transport minister and should know all about this stuff. So I maintain that we should be electrifying our main railway lines all over Australia and electrifying all the coal lines in the iron ore lines in the Pilbara and coal lines in New South Wales and the other lines in Queensland in particular, where vast tonnages of these minerals are hauled. That would be, I think, in some ways easier to do than to try and electrify the road fleet, which are all owned by, you know, individual little companies and so on and so forth.
Well, Albanese talks about spending nearly $100 billion on the fast link between Sydney and Newcastle. So I suppose if that money could be converted to do this, yeah, you'd do the job, wouldn't you?
Well, that's just planning money, of course, $100 million. He wants us just to plan it, not build it.
I'm sorry, it's billion, though. That's the billion cost.
Well, I thought the figure was $100 million, and I thought that was just money to plan it. I didn't think
they're saying 93 billion, but it'll blow out from there. So you're looking.
Well, I think. They have to rethink, passenger rail can't really haul freight as well. The tracks aren't really.
Yeah, but I'm saying
compatible.
That if you redirected that money into doing what you're saying, you'd have the money for it.
Yeah, yeah, and you can, if you can tolerate running your fast passenger trains, say 200 kilometres an hour rather than 300 kilometres an hour, then the tracks can haul both freight trains and fast passenger trains all at the same time. And I think for Australia that would be far more sensible. It would still leave the really long flight routes probably being more sensible to keep flying on those, but for the shorter ones, suddenly rail at even 200 kilometres an hour, say between Sydney and Melbourne, with the passenger rail taking about 6 hours, would suddenly become quite quite attractive to a lot of users, and they'd be travelling on extremely low emission transport because the energy being used would be generated by solar panels and wind farms, rather than aeroplanes that have to use, either aviation fuel that's presently processed from petrol or these artificial fuels that they're talking about, which are going to be extremely expensive. So,
yeah, and of course, in the 6 hours you go from city centre to city centre, so you haven't lost all that time at airport and waiting at airports and getting all this. So it would compare favourably, in fact.
Well, it sounds a long. It sounds like a long trip, but that's the trip from the centre of Melbourne, say, to the centre of Sydney. It doesn't include, you don't have to have, trips out to the airport and then schlep around going through ticketing and security and all of those sort of things. That's what you avoid. So you hop on the train, and if you're an industrious businessman, you plonk yourself in your comfortable seat and start doing business while you travel using your phone and your laptop. So, that makes the trip a lot more attractive even to the business class, but I'd assume that some of those will still want to fly for sort of prestige reasons. But the fares should be a whole lot higher than they are, of course, because there's no charge in the current fares that covers the cost of carbon or anything like that, because we don't do things like that in Australia. Forgive my cynicism, but yeah. So there's road transport to be electrified, but there's also, I think, in many ways, an easier thing to electrify would be the rail lines, not the main rail lines. I'm not saying the whole network, although you'd keep on expanding over time, running more and more of it electrically, and of course batteries are getting huge and efficient, and there's no reason why locomotives couldn't be battery powered in some cases as well. That's the sort of thing that Twiggy Forrester's looking at on the Fortescue network of iron ore lines in Western Australia. He's been quite progressive over there in his move towards electrifying his whole network of transport and processing over there. He wants to electrify all the big machines that are used in the mines as well as the trains.
And he's even clashing with poor Gina over the diesel fuel rebate for the mining company. Gina insists that it must be kept.
Well, Gina never saw a dollar she didn't want to hold on to, did she?
No. Terrible thing, that.
And she's in a position to grab as many dollars as she wants, yes.
Yeah. John, interesting situation that they're currently the Mikey system is being tested, this new one where you can just, use a credit card or whatever on a couple of lines, including the Upfield line. But, of course, now we've gone free public transport for a month. The test can't be tested.
No.
But nonetheless, the cost blowout's $137 million at the moment, of blowout in terms of doing it. But also, even in what's happened so far, there's been some problems because apparently if you get your smart watch or your wallet or whatever with your card too close to the reader, it zaps anyway, and people have been charged a couple of times for the same fare, or being charged for a fare they didn't even take because they got too close to the reader. So there's all sorts of problems being revealed already.
Well, that sounds like the readers themselves are too sensitive, and they're picking up cards, when people are walking past, say, half a metre away from the reader. The reader's still saying, oh, goody, I can collect another fare. But, of course, our public transport's so good, Kevin. Why would anybody complain about paying twice?
Well, That's right, John. You're spot on there. There's no question of that. But nonetheless, some people are complaining, John. And in fact, one woman found that she got charged for a fare she didn't take. But then the Allen government said the readers have been designed to only charge for intentional taps by passengers and encourage commuters to contact Transport Victoria for reimbursement if needed. So that should be pretty good.
They
should get their reimbursement in 3 or 4 years, I would have thought.
Yes, that sounds like a nightmare, another nightmare situation for the poor commuters, Well, of course, with the free public transport, I mean, a lot of people who, you know, leaving their car at home and then trying to get to the station on the usually pathetic bus services and then take the train are going to find out taking public transport, is often a nightmare, and they're going to be very, very keen to probably go back to their car, whatever the price of petrol is, which is very sad.
If people do flock onto public transport because of this at the moment, they're going to need to upgrade or run them much more frequently or something, aren't they? Because they're going to get quite crowded.
Well, you'd hope that a lot more people are going to be getting onto public transport, and yes, you'd hope they can run more trains. In fact, probably what they can do is run services more like peak hour all day. That's probably what they could do. But many of the bus services, even in peak hour, the service levels are pathetic at the moment. And so, you know, good luck is all I can say, really. I mean, it'll vary line by line such a lot. Some lines will be... it'll be possible to use the trains and the trams and the buses because there is enough capacity, but a lot of them there won't be. The things will get very crammed. For instance, the services from say Geelong, and they're going to include the whole V Line network in the free month as well. Those services are already very crowded, so I don't know what they're going to do there. I don't know if they've got. I don't think they've got enough rolling stock to really improve the service levels very much. Yeah, so, you know, people trying to use public transport aren't going to get a very good impression of what's available.
No, but we'll see, I guess. But the government says that these, and given that most places, you know, there's places around the world where these things all seem to work very smoothly, these ticketing systems, the government said we're delivering the projects Victoria needs, but it usually takes about 4 years to introduce a new ticket system. That seems pretty extraordinary, I would have thought.
Well, I think they've had their 4 years.
Yes.
I don't think they should really need any more. Certainly... Sydney, I think Brisbane and Perth already have systems where you can just tap on with your credit card. So, you know, we're behind the eight ball, I'm afraid, and I think our Mikey system has got complications to it that many other systems don't have. So, you know, it's quite complex, I think, the current system. Yeah.
Well, there's also a story that a farmer was given 28 million compo for potentially losing land for the outer metropolitan ring road. But what I found fascinating was the proposal, even though at this stage it's just there's 28 million going into a business case to have a look at it, but
right.
The proposed project backed by the state advisory body Infrastructure Victoria is a freeway and rail route to connect the M80 Ring Road in Bundoora to the Princes Highway near Werribee and link major freight hubs, easing pressure on the Hume Freeway. Do you know much about this project?
Well, there is the proposal for an outer ring road. That's been floated around at some level of government for quite a while, that we need another ring road north of the present ring road that, you know, is being finished off with this hugely expensive link out in out in where is it?
Northwest.
That's the present one that they're finishing. Well, the gap.
A bit of both, actually.
So yeah, well, the present link is incredibly expensive. Huge long tunnels, blah blah blah. But they've decided they need an outer ring road. Well, it's true that the present ring road gets incredibly busy during peak periods, and there seem to always be accidents happening in peak hours, so the whole thing gets congested with people crawling along at a snail's pace. You know, the whole thing is a bit of a nightmare. So the only thing you can do, of course, when that happens to roads is build another road. You know, it's the only...
it talks about a freeway and rail route. Is there a...
Well, that's the
road will come first, obviously.
Oh, obviously, Kevin. Yeah, but we can only hope if it goes ahead that they leave a wide enough median in the middle of the corridor for a double track railway, and of course at the same time they have to make sure that the grades and curves are such that the trains can run at a good speed on the line. You know, that's not always guaranteed, of course, when our planners get their teeth into something. But that's all talk. We're all talking about 20 or 30 years down the line, I think, for that sort of thing to happen. But it'd be nice to see some things finished first, and, you know, there are a couple of big depots in construction, if not finished, for transshipping freight off trains to trucks for delivery around Melbourne or to the docks, and that's worthwhile. But these things always seem to take forever to happen here in Melbourne. I can envisage that a lot of trucks, you know, there are many thousands of trucks a day travel between Sydney and Melbourne. I can imagine that the loads that are on those trucks currently should be on big, long, electrified container trains on an upgraded railway line that could do the trip between Sydney and Melbourne in, you know, well under 10 hours, which would be speeds that the trucks can't manage, but it'd be done with renewable electricity. So, you know, it would be both good for the economy and good for the environment as well. But waiting for those sort of things to happen, who knows how long we'll have to wait. But if somebody got planning, you could have the line electrified, I would have thought, in 3 or 4 years maximum.
And, of course, the money's there if you want to put it in that direction. I mean, we could even put some of the AUKUS money toward it, I suppose. You know,
thing, Kevin, yeah. We keep sort of forgetting about AUKUS. There's this huge cost floating around, you know, with our promises to Pete Hegseth that we're going to help finance all these nuclear submarines.
Well, the original estimate of AUKUS costs was that Dave Sweeney at the ACF worked this one out. Yeah. It's $38 million a day for the time of the contract. $38 million a day would buy a lot of stuff.
Yeah. How many billion was it all up? Was it 300
it's 300 and something, yeah. But yeah. It's $38 million a day over the length of the contract, yeah.
Yeah, well, as soon as the announcement was made about AUKUS and the cost of it, I'm afraid I thought, oh, well, there goes any money for rail upgrades. You know, it's all disappeared down the gullet of AUKUS.
That's right. We're going to rather spend it on killing people.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to help them.
And boosting the stock exchange valuation of some of the big arms manufacturing companies in the USA.
Well, on that cheery note, we're going to have to wind up.
Are we?
Time's up, but... We'll do more of this next month, John. Don't worry.
Okay.
All right. But, John, thanks for your time this morning again. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, folks.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll keep asking the questions. I don't know if we'll get any answers. Yeah.
Okay. More questions next month. John McPherson there from Australia, from he's our guru on public transport.
I'm a guru.
Yeah, that's right.
I think I'd rather be a guru, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
You can call me a guru if you like.
Okay, guru. At this stage, it's huru, John. I'll see you next month. And next week is energy issues, and we're going to talk about energy issues next week. No idea what, but we'll talk about something. And Timothy, thanks heaps for keeping us on it.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.